Hello, I'm Audrey Brown, and today in Focus on Africa, what's behind the massive shortage of university professors in Tanzania? We'll also explore if it's putting students off pursuing a life of the mind.
The shortage of professors in my country affects me a lot because it limits my search for knowledge due to lack of consultation from professors. And yes, I would like to pursue academia journey so that I become the youngest professor in my country.
And the Eritrean cyclist Binyam Girme made history at the Tour de France recently.
We don't really see many black riders, especially from Africa, competing in the Tour de France. So for Binyam to not only be competing, but to also win a much coveted stage, it's incredible. And he's proven himself right now to be amongst some of the best riders in the world.
Will that translate into more diversity in this grueling sport? It's Tuesday, the 9th of July. First, we go to the burning sands of the Sahara and the chilling waves of the Mediterranean. A new report by the United Nations claims that land routes out of Africa and into Europe are now twice as deadly as the sea route across the Mediterranean Sea, which also happens to be the deadliest maritime passage. The study, done with the Mixed Migration Center Research Group, also claims that more undocumented people and refugees are crossing the Sahara Desert, where criminal gangs enslave, rape and torture them. And there's a new form of systemic abuse and forced organ removal. Recent and ongoing conflicts in places like Mali, Burkina Faso and Sudan have raised the number of people heading north. European countries have tried to staunch these inflows, but with little seeming success. Various schemes to keep people on the other side of the Mediterranean has cost lots of money, and yet more and more people arrive, and many others die trying. So let's try to get to the bottom of this with Guillaume Sotomayor, a private consultant and non-resident fellow at the Middle East Institute. He's an expert on West and Central Africa, and he's based in Dakar. Why are more people dying in the desert than in the deep blue sea?
It's a very difficult numbers to assess, but yes, it does. Not only because of geographical and climate conditions in the Saharan Desert, crossing not only across Libya and Niger, but also across Mali and Algeria in direction to the Mediterranean Sea. The issue that you know most migrants have been facing there is the repression of several militias, but also of government forces. We can only, you know, assess these numbers and assess these tragic realities based on the testimonies of migrants that are returning, sometimes with nothing and signs of torture, in Niger or more south, returning from Libya or returning from Algeria.
So these are the people that have failed that are giving the information. So we don't even know of the numbers of people who try and succeed and die in the desert.
Absolutely. Absolutely. That's exactly the problem that we are having here. So the numbers might be even higher. We are basing, you know, like on a number of again, very quite precise and cross-check testimonies.
We report on this very often, and we've been reporting on this for the last 10, 15, even 20 years, perhaps. But it's just getting worse. More and more people from
Absolutely.
Larger parts of the world, not just African countries, are coming through these routes. They
Yes.
know that it's dangerous. It is getting more dangerous. And the countries that you mentioned, Libya, for instance, has agreements with EU countries who are trying to stop these numbers of people crossing the Mediterranean and getting into Europe. What are those policies and why do they seem not to be working?
Yes, first, you're absolutely right to mention the fact that also you have now Asian migrants, notably from Bangladesh and other countries that are crossing to the same routes. What we can actually say, you know, it is very basic. This, the EU strategy of outsourcing border control to third countries has led to widespread, not only human rights violation, but also to more migration. It is totally counterproductive. And it is what the last report that I wrote for the Middle East Institute was stressing out. Migrants not only face severe abuses by local security forces, but the policies have bolstered criminal networks involved in human trafficking.
In what way, though? Because we see, I mean, for instance, in this country, in the UK, the Rwanda policy, as it was called by the Tory government, who's now left power, has been that they want to stop human trafficking. They want to stop people coming in on small boats. And the Rwanda policy being that people won't be allowed to seek asylum in this country. They'll go to Rwanda and they will be processed there. That's one policy. And it was designed very specifically to stop human trafficking. But that's not happening. The business model, as it was called, hasn't been broken.
Externalization of EU migration controls has inadvertently reinforced the same reasons, the same people and institution, public and private, parapublic, that are creating migration. Local militias, security forces, often involved in human trafficking themselves, benefit from the funds and support provided under these policies. And this financial support, this technical support, sometimes this even diplomatic support, enabled them to continue their exploitative practices with impunity. The focus on security-centric initiatives divert attention from the necessary governance reforms and it's from the true issues that underlie, that motivate migration, which is that people are not only looking for better living conditions, so better development projects and development perspectives, but also it's not only a poverty and lack of opportunities, but also they're looking for better governance. They're looking for a hope in governance. And I would just want here to mention the example of Ghana, where the people that I interviewed in Ghana recently were so disgruntled with the current president and his government, who's been in power for two terms, that they've been losing hope in the capacity of the country to reform itself and to treat better its own population, to implement more justice, more social justice, more economic justice. And in that regard, you have very highly qualified people from Ghana, doctors and so on, really well trained, going not only to the European Union, to the UK, but also to the United States.
Why do you think then, if it's so clear for you as somebody who studies the issue, and no doubt governments have people that study the issue as well, that the policies that are pursued are not actually having the desired effect?
So sometimes because they are motivated by very short-term political gains and political communication gains, so we want to pretend that we are working on it and satisfy our public opinion with it, because we don't, as Europeans and Americans, we are not able right now to generate a narrative where migrants and people from different, and asylum seekers, but people from different parts of the world are valued for their actually, you know, very real and pragmatic cultural, human, economic contributions to our society. We are not able to actually project ourselves with a cohesive message. But the other issue is that the EU and most Western powers have built their anti-migration policies on the stabilization narrative, which aims to create a semblance of stability through election economic activities. And this narrative has been, in my view, fundamentally flawed.
And now we're looking at governments, well, just two really, that have changed. We're looking at France, where we may see a more left-wing coalition government coming in power right now. And in the UK, we are seeing a Labour Party that may or may not have slightly different policies. Do you think that they will approach the issue differently? The Labour Party has already said that it scrapped the Rwanda scheme that the Conservatives were punting quite heavily.
I certainly hope so, because right now it is not only inhumane and most of the time illegal or on the brink of illegality, but most of these policies are, as I told you, completely counterproductive. And in that sense, it is a waste of taxpayer money, and this refundation needs to be thorough and urgent. I really would like to advocate for prioritizing governance reforms and the support to build effective institutions and ensuring accountability. Transparency and accountability in aid policies are, in my view, you know, the crucial element to prevent the inadvertent support of oppressive regimes, oppressive militias, oppressive interlocutors that are creating migration. We need to uphold human rights standards. We need to apply consistent standards across all countries receiving funding. It is a profound introspection that is needed right now from most of Western aid.
You sound almost old-fashioned when you talk about, when you appeal for, you know, legality. It's almost you're making a case for morality here. For many governments, they believe that that is not a position that they can embrace. I mean, they tie themselves in knots in a way to try and justify their actions because they believe their populations will not agree with them.
Absolutely.
You said they're creating a narrative, but do you think that people actually are more generous and more welcoming than what governments say they are and base their policies on?
I think, it is this kind of a self-fulfilling prophecy, isn't it? We created a narrative, the stabilization narrative, saying, but if you check a few boxes, election, a little bit of economic activity, the country is in a better path, a path of stability, a path of development. And so with this path, governments did believe in the 90s, especially until today, that with that two boxes checked, only the countries then will be on a path where people wouldn't migrate. It is a flawed analysis, because then if you continue to support blindly interlocutors that are, the problem, you'll become a problem yourself. And so my point is actually very pragmatic in a way. I'm trying to be, I think that right now moral arguments, unfortunately, and legal arguments have very little grasp on people.
Guillaume Sotomayor, private consultant and non-resident fellow at the Middle East Institute. Tanzania has been grappling with a shortage of university professors and other academic staff for years now, and it's bad. Government figures reveal that more than 200,000 young people enroll at universities each year, but there are just over 200 professors that are actively teaching them. This is clearly not enough. So what is stopping people from entering the academy to teach? We'll hear from Dr. George Kahangwa, a senior lecturer in education at the University of Dar es Salaam in just a bit. But let's hear first from students who are affected by this. Helena John is a PhD student at the University of Dodoma.
The shortage of professors in my country affects me a lot because it limits my search for knowledge due to lack of consultation from professors. And yes, I would like to pursue for further academia journey so that I become the youngest professor in my country.
Mariana Kunja is a second-year undergraduate pursuing a bachelor's degree in public administration and leadership at Mzumbe University.
It hinders the development of specialized courses and limits research output. Research opportunities and overall academic experience for students is not well met as a basic need. I would like to become a professor because it will address the shortage and make a meaningful difference in education system.
Both Helena and Mariana want to become academics themselves, but what are the factors that discourage so many others from doing the same? Let's listen to the conversation I had with Dr. George Kahangwa. He wants to become a professor himself, so he began by describing the path to becoming one.
You don't wake up in the morning and become a professor. It's a journey. For instance, someone can start as a tutorial assistant, and this is a bachelor degree holder who has at least the GPA of 3.8 and above. Then if the university is interested in this young person, he is recruited to become the member of academic staff. And then after successful pursuit of a master degree, one becomes an assistant lecturer. Then, of course, this person has an obligation to do a PhD, after which that qualifies a person to become a lecturer. And after some time, when this lecturer publishes and works with the university after PhD for at least 3 years, and the publications have to be counted, then the person can be promoted to a senior lecturer. After that level of being a senior lecturer, 3 years later, and with successful publication, then one can be promoted to an associate professor. Then 3 more years or even more than that, with a good publication, one becomes a professor.
Right. So how long can that period take?
If you take those, tutorial, assistant lecturer, lecturer, senior lecturer to associate, those are 5. So 5 times at least 3 years, that is 15 years before someone becomes an associate professor.
So what are the roadblocks to becoming a professor?
It's very difficult, for instance, to publish, especially when you are not getting opportunities to undertake research. Without doing research, you are not likely to publish.
How far off are you in your journey? Is that where you're heading? Because you're a senior lecturer,
right?
For me,
I'm now a senior lecturer, yes. And I'm trying to publish. When I'm done with the requirements, if I estimate that these publications are enough, then I can lodging my application to be promoted.
Right. Okay. Well, I wish you well on the journey. But why is there a shortage in Tanzania with professors and senior academic staff?
The reasons for that are several. For instance, in the early 2000s and maybe even earlier than that, in the 1990s, the government stopped recruiting the academic staff for universities. So there was that gap that was created for almost 10 years plus. Then comes Magufuli's regime. He appointed a lot of academic staff from the universities to take up senior positions in the government. So when he did that, they were not replaced by fresh academic staff. At the same time, new universities were emerging, including private universities. So they were all, the public and the private ones, were fighting for just a little academic staff who are available or those who qualify. And these private universities are also given conditions by the regulatory authority, Tanzania Commission for Universities. They cannot take anyone who does not have qualifications. For instance, what I told you about the GPA of 3.8. So it was like the scramble for just a few people who are available. And, you know, 3.8 is not a grade which many students end up getting. And even some of those who get 3.8 are not interested in working as academic staff in universities because they think somewhere else it is greener than working in the universities.
How well are lecturers and academic staff and professors and so on paid in Tanzania? Is it one of the better paid professions in the country?
No, it's not. For a professor, it's just around 5 million, and that is for before you get some deductions, the taxes and the like. So when it is that much, little as compared to what others are earning in the private sector and other parastatals, the politicians, the members of parliament and the like, the university dons are actually not to say underpaid, but the payment is not that good.
What's the rate, to help our listeners, of one Tanzanian shilling to a dollar?
A dollar is now equivalent to 2,600 points Tanzanian shillings.
Okay, so people can do the math because I can't count.
Yeah.
So is this situation, this shortage that you find in the academy in Tanzania, is that the case across the continent and in other parts of the world as well, or is this very specific to Tanzania?
You know, African countries actually face similar problems, but we might differ a little bit. But I think things are better in Global North because, you know, for instance, the question of research funding, I think for you who are in Europe and elsewhere, it's not that a big problem. And you actually find that in our universities, in our African countries, research is predominantly financed by foreign financiers. And we are most of the time forced to collaborate with people from America and Europe because they can easily access the funds and then we have to collaborate with them. So when they can easily access funds, you know, apart from what you get from your salary, research also pays. So someone might stay working with the university in Europe or in America, not because maybe the salary is good, but the research package. The research fund is flowing in, and therefore you are busy working on your research and you can easily publish and the like.
So what's the effect of this shortage on the quality of education in Tanzania, tertiary education?
Several effects. It undermines the quality. The quality of education will definitely go down because you can imagine when I have a class of 3,000 students, the two of us are actually teaching that course. Then we have to do the marking of essay kind of questions. Then you have 2 weeks to mark 3,000 scripts times maybe four essays. Then,
wow.
Then that is really very, very, very tough.
Why did the government in the 90s freeze recruitment of lecturers, and why did it happen again, given that it has such a massive impact on the quality of education, but also on the quality of life for you as a lecturer, because you have to do quite a lot of work for not very much remuneration?
Yeah, you might remember back in the 1980s when we had economic challenges, institutions such as the IMF had suggested to our governments that they should reduce spending, they should cut off spending. The strategies which were used by then and which had an impact in the 1990s is that the spending into education and other social services has to touch recruitment, has to touch the salary bill, the wage bill, which is actually touching the lecturers. So when you reduce the number, you pay a few, and then you don't have that burden of paying a lot. Because up to now, actually, our salaries for public universities come from the government. So it's just a question of, political decisions and the economic situation.
So is the Tanzanian government worried about the situation, and what more can they do?
I think they are concerned. And of recent, I heard the Minister of Education talking about it, and they actually said they are looking into it, how they can allow foreigners to come work in our universities. What they are doing now is to ask any Tanzanian who has a good GPA and who is interested to join the university for working and is already employed, that person can actually join us. So at least that's what they are doing for now.
For somebody listening right now, thinking whether or not a career in the academy is worth it or not, what would you say to them?
Choosing a career is not just about money. When you work with a university, you interact with a lot of people. Whenever I visit upcountry, I meet a lot of people, some of whom I've actually forgotten. They call me their teacher. They treat me very well. So those are the kind of benefits that you end up getting. And when you work as a professor in a university, you participate in research undertaking, and research end up generating new knowledge. So you are the first person, for instance, to know something new. So that is also very interesting. So you have to like the work and be interested in it, even when you don't think payment is that good.
Okay, so it's respect, and it's also knowing things and seeing knowledge expand, not just about money. Thank you very much.
Yeah, for sure.
All right,
you're
then.
You're welcome.
Dr. George Kahangwa is a senior lecturer in education at the University of Dar es Salaam. This is Focus on Africa from the BBC World Service. Now, let's get on our bikes and join Binyam Girmay, who made history at the Tour de France last week. We will never catch up with him or any of the thousands of elite cyclists who undertake the grueling race every year. Binyam became the first Black African cyclist to win a stage in the race's 121-year history. He's also the only Black rider in the whole peloton of 176 riders. Now, as the tour continues, let's ride along to see how Binyam could change the face of cycling. But first, how did he get into cycling as a competitive sport?
In Eritrea, cycling is number one sport. Yeah, more than football. It's really like from long time story from the
Italian
corner days. The culture of cycling and the people, they are really big fan of cycling. Especially, to be honest, also more local. Yeah. Races is famous than the international. First, my parents, they are really passionate about cycling, especially my father. And then I started cycling when I was 12 years old. My older brother, he was already started cycling. So when I was 12 years old, this is like really I start racing and focus only on the cycling close to school. And also near my home, there was a local team. So I always went there to see how they prepare the bikes and all the stuff. And also the race is mostly in the capital city, so I grew up there. So yeah, my whole life is created with cycling.
That's the Eritrean cyclist Binyam Girmay talking to Mani Arthur, the British Ghanaian cyclist who founded the Black Cyclist Network to encourage more diversity in the sport. Mani and I continue the conversation he started with Binyam. Hello.
Hello, Audrey.
How are you?
I'm good, thank you. I'm good. Just watching the Tour de France. I am campaigning for everyone to ignore watching England and watch the Tour de France.
you're going there. You're going to the football as well.
Yes, I want all the smoke.
Oh, wow. I am going to have to ask you why. because, you know, watching people on a cycle, all you're really waiting to do is see who's going to crash and fall. What is the pleasure in watching the Tour de France?
What makes it really interesting is that, first of all, you have to then battle with the terrain. So some of the stages are going to be flat, you know, flat road, which is usually the easy stage, which is for the sprinters. So if you can imagine, in the race itself, you have all these teams, you have 180 riders, and within those 180 riders, you have about 10, 15 riders that are designated sprinters that are going to be competing for the flat stages. So they're pure sprinters. And then you also have within that, you know, group of riders, you also have riders that are all-rounders, and then you have riders that are very slim, sprinters, endurance athletes. These are the riders that usually get the yellow jersey at the end of the Tour de France. So if you're looking at it, what makes cycling really fascinating when you look at the body composition of these riders is you have riders that are like the Usain Bolts of this world, of the athletics world. And then you have riders that are like, you know, Kipchoge or, you know, Mo Farah. And so you got all these riders all bunched up together and they're all competing for different things. So for the casual observer, you look at it and you're like, it all seems like it's just everyone is going for the same goal. But no, there's a lot of, you know, factors and, you know, it's almost like a chess piece. You know, teams are going for certain things, riders are going for certain things.
Okay, so how big a moment is it that Binyam has won a stage as a black cycling fan?
Yeah.
What does it mean?
So just to give you, you know, an idea, at this year's Tour de France, Binyam is the only black rider in the Tour this year. The Tour is a very European-centric event. So one way to look at it is almost to look at it like, you know, like the winter ski X Games or whatever. It's like that. So we don't really see many black riders, especially from Africa, competing in the Tour de France. So for Binyam to not only be competing, but to also win a much coveted stage, it's incredible. And he's proven himself right now to be amongst some of the best riders in the world. So, and his journey is amazing.
Yeah, we'll talk about his journey in a moment. Let's talk about the stage that he won. What's so special about it?
What was special about that stage was, you know, I talk about the profile of each stage. Some stages will go through these incredibly high mountains. And then you have certain stages that are completely kind of flat, where the pure sprinters, the Usain Bolts of the cycling world, would usually capture those stages. Binyam is not really a pure sprinter. He's kind of, you know, he's somewhere in the middle. But he, you know, went up against some of these pure sprinters, Mark Cavendish, Groenewegen, Philipsen, and he beat them. And I was sitting at home thinking, no, this is not happening. And he crossed the line first and beat those fast men. So for me, it was just incredible to see. But it goes to show just how talented he is and how, you know, versatile he is as a rider.
So what makes him a great cyclist?
I think Binyam was born at altitude. So he was raised in Asmara, Eritrea. And in Asmara, it's a very sort of, you know, mountainous region of Africa, Eritrea. And growing up there, he grew up above, you know, above sea level. So he naturally he's got the endurance. Cycling, ultimately, it's an endurance sport. It's a marathon. And I think he, because of where he grew up and the fact that he started cycling at the age of 12, it's all sort of culminated in producing this incredible athlete. And not to forget, at 17, he had to leave his family behind and move to Europe by himself to try and pursue his career of becoming a pro cyclist. So I'm really happy for him. At the age of, 15, 16, he had already been scouted. When he was in Rwanda, that's when he got spotted by the UCI. The UCI is the governing body for cycling in Europe and around the world. They're a bit like FIFA in football in terms. And they have a program, they call it the World Cycling Program, which basically gets talented riders from countries around the world who do not have the infrastructure to develop those riders.
So the fact that he came through structures means that the sport is quite big, cycling. How big is it actually in Eritrea and across the continent?
It's huge in Eritrea. I think it stems from, you know, Eritrea being a former colony of Italy. So in the 1940s, you know, I think the Italians introduced cycling into Eritrea. And the people kind of took it up. But not just Eritrea, Ethiopia, Sierra Leone has a good history. And Mauritius, Morocco, mostly is tied to countries that are linked to, you know, European countries that had a tradition of cycling that, you know, were, you know, colonial powers in those countries in Africa. So if you look at Algeria, for example, because of their French connection, you know, they've got a very great cycling heritage in Africa as well as Egypt.
Okay, well, I should point out that as a South African, very specifically, Cape Town has a tradition of cycling as well. Cape Town.
Forgive me, I forgot to mention South Africa, which is huge. It's huge. I mean, we've had most Tour de France riders that have come from Africa, have come from South Africa.
That's why the point is made that he's the first Black African to win a stage, right? So why has this moment taken so long, given that, as you've just pointed out, cycling as a sport is quite well entrenched in various countries?
I think that the main issue is it's lack of participation. You know, I think the lazy answer would be, you know, to sort of blame it on some sort of, you know, racial injustice or et cetera, et cetera. But, you know, for me, when I look at the evidence, you know, I don't think there's gatekeeping, because there just isn't enough Black and brown riders knocking on the doors for it to be a factor. And I think the key thing is that there just isn't enough participation from Black and brown riders. And I think some of that, probably one of the key reasons why, is because cycling in itself is a very expensive sport. It didn't used to be, but now if you're looking, you can go on Google and search for a road bike, and it might cost you an arm and a leg to buy one. And then secondly, cycling is centered in Europe. And so for African riders to try and, you know, get into Europe, they have to deal with visa issues. And a lot of teams, cycling teams, would rather not have to go through the battle of trying to secure visas and work permits. So when faced with a choice of selecting a European rider or an African rider, they tend to go for the European rider.
Binyam is quoted as saying, "We must be proud. Now we are part of the big races and we have success. Now is our moment. Now is our time. This is for all Africa." He clearly sees this as a moment that encompasses a continent. What did he say to you when you interviewed him?
We didn't really talk about how he saw himself as an advocate for Black and brown cyclists in the sport. What he did say to me was he had just enjoyed riding his bike, and he liked riding his bike, but he didn't necessarily like the politics, and he didn't want to be at the center. The attention that he was getting was something that he had to really sort of work on, because he had to be guarded about what came out of his mouth. So I sensed that he was uncomfortable about being pushed into the limelight. But I would say that from the quote that you've given, what he has shown is that he has grown tremendously. I mean, a very short space of time, and he is willing to embrace being a role model and being a central figure. And I think it speaks for all of us when he does say that, because it's forcing the cycling world to really have a look and think about what they can do, what we can do as, you know, as a cycling community.
Yeah, because there is the saying, isn't there, you've got to see it to be it. So do you think that Binyam, just by his mere presence and having won, would be an encouragement to young people around the world to take up the sport?
I'm a living embodiment of this, because I started cycling back in 2009. I'm based here in London, but I'm Ghanaian. I'm of Ghanaian heritage. And so in 2000, I ended up competing, representing Ghana at the African Games in 2019. I've since represented Ghana at you know, African Games in 2020. Two, and also the Commonwealth Games. And I never got a chance to race with Binyam, but I got a chance to race with his countrymen and women, and also with, you know, the great Mark Cavendish at the Commonwealth Games. And for me, in 2018, I created Black Cyclist Network here in London, which has since grown. At first, I didn't really see much diversity within the sports in London. But within 5 years, everything, there's been like a paradigm shift. There's so many black and brown people getting into cycling, and most of them have come through Black Cyclist Network, which is the club that I created. We're now Europe's biggest cycling club, targeted at black and brown people, but not exclusively to black and brown people, because we welcome everyone despite no matter what your skin color is. So he's doing it on a grander scale because, you know, more eyeballs are watching him.
Thank you so much. It's been so interesting talking to you. Thank you.
Absolutely. My pleasure.
And that was a fascinating conversation with Manny Arthur, the British Ghanaian cyclist and founder of Black Cyclists Network. Focus on Africa came together due to the efforts of Joseph Keane and Yasha Michelle here in London. Charles Kitonga was on the case from Nairobi. Patricia Whitehorn was the senior journalist in charge of quality and content. Nick Randell was our technical producer. Andre Lombard and Alice Mudengi are our editors. I'm Audrey Brown. Until next time, thanks for your company.